in tene men calling for the apart as some justification. Who is Anil? Who is Anil? Like, what is Anil in the world?
With reference to the present
Anil, you know how Anil was built up. Anil was built up as Anagarika Dharmapala, grand nephew. And the only other Goigama figure next to NMN Devi. That was the basis on which he was built up in Yellow Festival.
But why
and
do
these shameless Colvins and others accepted that as the position?
So why do these
consciously
other castes accept this domination?
That is the that is the setup in Ceylon. That is their level. They think that in parliamentary politics, you have to accept the fact that a Goigama must lead. Because the country has a majority of Goigama.
This is a sector.
I mean, people like Colvin consciously express that fact in acknowledging Anil as a potential leader.
But I thought there is a Colvinar faction and Anil Mulasinghe faction, there is some enmity.
That is now. That is because the inner party squabble.
Oh, Aglavat.
Not only over Aglavat, even about the question of Anil having become a minister and all those things. Now Anil feels that Colvin has stepped into his shoes. And that next time, probably Colvin will not hesitate to accept a ministry. Last time they were too shamefaced, you see. Now they have lost all pretense.
But isn't there a possibility that by being, say, a group within this HLSP, they might have some influence on its policy and radicalize policy sufficiently to split the right wing of the SLSP away from the party and make Mrs. Bandaranaike lean more on them?
No. That's their fond imagining. That's their process by which they rationalize their presence there. Whatever is to be radicalized in the SLSP will not be radicalized by them. If at all, whatever is to be radicalized by in the SLFP will be radicalized by the political situation in the country. Today already, in my view, there are SLFPers straight who are becoming more radical in their thinking than LSSPers. Not under LSSP influence, under the influence of the political situation in which they themselves are evolving.
This may be rationalization, but I think they also argue that SLSP is based on rural mass, and of course, since they are parliamentary oriented, they would like to have the support of the rural masses, and they feel this can only be done through the SLSP. And by joining the SLSP, they can radicalize these masses.
The masses will get radicalized in spite of them, and when the rural masses get radicalized, if they are the government, they'll try to hold them back. That's what will happen. So long as the masses are not radicalized, they'll be divided between the UNP and the SLFP. When they become radicalized, they'll break with the parliamentary setup, which includes the LSSP. The LSSP is no longer going to be the pole of attraction for the rural masses if they break with the parliamentary setup. Within the parliamentary setup, they will swing and oscillate between these two formations. They have nothing else. They are like caged animals with only two compartments to choose to be in, one or the other. But I would say already now, for instance, amongst the working class, I can tell you that today, quite a number of the younger, new, proletarian elements, they see that, and they have no illusion whatsoever in this setup.
But I thought that the LSSP, that your party, has only got a very small following at the moment.
That is direct political adherence. But for the line that I am today taking in the working class movement, I can tell you that we will have many more people.
But still,
I mean, we can't jump outside the parliamentary context, as it were, by a mere expression of a wish or explanation of the necessity. People have themselves got to find that it doesn't take them anywhere. I don't say that the masses of the people have yet come to that conclusion. They will probably go through at least another election, if they can get the chance to have it, and probably put back this SLFP coalition. But when that coalition is put back, what will happen? It will get smashed to bits in conflicting currents. How long will it hold together? What will hold it together? Nothing. Because all the frustrations that are now heaping up under the UNP will come into the open if they come back. What will they do? In my view, they'll probably resort to the bomb and the bullet without the slightest hesitation to try to keep them under control. And when the frustration grows beyond certain bounds, people are not going to be put down by the threat of the Singh regime. You would have noticed that Mrs. Bandaranaike relied far more on the Singh regime than even the UNP. The only hope they'll have is to get massive Soviet aid. And the Soviet Union already is, even under this regime, exerting pressure against China. I understand that this ban on this Chinese literature, even, although I thought it was probably due to American pressure, somebody told me the other day that it's more likely that it was due to Soviet pressure.
So how reliable is this information?
I don't know. I myself, when I made that public meeting, I said that this was probably a pinprick, political pimping at China to satisfy the Americans in getting an IMF loan or to sort of show their political credentials. But somebody else said that they had these Chinese magazines had indulged in such strong attacks on the Soviet Union and their so-called revisionism that they had objected diplomatically.
With reference to the younger sections of the trade union movement, how strong is the influence of the CP Moscow?
Not much. I don't think that either the CP Moscow wing or communist wing or Peking wing is going to cut much ice with the working class youth. No.
They might with the undergraduates.
University intelligentsia types, traditionally, you find a section who are taken up with the mighty Soviet Union, mighty China, even in the United States, even in Berlin. I found you get those chaps. I bought a copy of Mao Zedong's, that Living Thoughts of Mao, Red Book. I bought it on the steps of University of California, Los Angeles, from a small Peking group, three or four chaps there. That is this, you know, Trotsky said that the petty bourgeois worships the established power. Both the Soviet Union and China are established, powerful, red powers. So when the petty bourgeois gets disgruntled with the capitalist regime that he finds himself under, his natural tendency is to look in the direction of established powers, because he has no power himself. He doesn't base himself on the power of the working class. So he looks for some other power. You see, the only power that one can base oneself on to fight the capitalist system is the working class. But in a country like Ceylon, building and organizing that power is a tough job. There are so many factors to surmount. There is the overall parliamentary illusion which divides the workers between these coalitions. There are the racial factors. There is the downright ignorance of the vastness of the proletarian plantation workers held down in a double serfdom of race and ignorance. Right. Then there is the Sinhalese worker still tied to his village largely, divided again by caste and religion. Then there is the overall general backwardness of the economy. So with all these factors there, to build a powerful working class base is not an easy task, especially with so many conflicting currents within the working class. But there is an overall radicalism in the Ceylon working class and an overall degree of consciousness which, in my view, proportional to the size of population, is the highest in the whole of Asia. And that is why whatever drawbacks there are in Ceylon, Ceylon is more democratic than almost any other country in Asia. Because in my view, democracy under any type of regime is in direct proportion to the power of the organization class.
You made the point that we haven't yet come to the time where the working class feels that it must break free from this political structure.
Yeah.
Doesn't that support the an imperial group policy of working, looking parliamentary work till that time comes? And can't they argue, this may be rationalization, but can't they argue, we must concentrate on the parliamentary role for the moment, but if we feel that the other moment, the time has come, we can switch to the...
Those people won't speak. They are giving the working class the experience of that road, but the fellows who give them that experience are not going to be the fellows who are going to take them beyond that experience. For that, the working class will have to turn away from them to us. Already they are turning away.
I was under the impression that some of the workers who had joined you in 64 are going back to this...
You are talking of individuals in the political party. I am talking of the broad class development. I say still the LSFTR as a political formation is virtually insignificant as a formation. It is what the LSFTR stands for and represents in the working class, which is what is significant. That's why I call it more a nucleus than a party. But what it stands for and represents is basically the break with the parliamentary setup and the posing of the necessity of the organization of the working class as a class under its own banner on an anti-capitalist revolutionary basis. Now, that does not mean, therefore, that the working class has already come to that understanding. No, but the objective situation is one in which already there are enough workers who instinctively sense that we have got to have a power base of our own. That is manifested by the way in which they come towards the CME. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows that I am the secretary of the LSSDR and that I am LSSDR. They don't come to the CMU because they accept the LSSDR. But they come to the CMU insofar as the CMU represents for them a concrete manifestation of the idea of workers' power. For instance, I put forward often the slogan, workers unite for workers' power. That's understood. Whoever is the government, now I can tell you quite recently, one of the drivers at coal stores. Who is the leader of the driver's section? So I joined the CNU. For 7 years, he was president of the SLFP union in coal stores. He now CNU member. The other day he was questioned in the general council. Why he joined? He said, because we have found from experience that change their policies is a change of government. The only union that doesn't and consistently fights for the interests of the workers, irrespective of the composition of the government, is the CNU. That's why he joined the CNU. Now that is from a man who for 7 years was the president of the SLFP branch at coal stores.
Incidentally, how badly were the unions as a whole, and the unions and the workers as a whole, affected by the law passed in Bandaranaike's time, which changed the existing law, which said that for a union to exist at a certain level, they had to have a certain percentage of the workers?
No, there was no law like that.
There was a regulation.
They introduced a rule that if any union had 40% of the workers of a given category in a workplace, say in a state corporation or even a private establishment, that it should be recognized.
Yes, but the SLSP changed it.
No, they brought that in, the 40% rule, as a rule of practice that helped to promote, shall I say, a greater degree of organization. That's about all. But that by itself is not of much significance, you see. Because the recognition of a union doesn't depend on its percentage at all. It depends on the capacity of the union to damage the employer. In fact, we are just now trying to settle this BCC strike, which has gone on now. Today is the 83rd day. And we have got out of 674 workers, they refused to negotiate with our union on the pretext, I say the pretext, that they were not sure about the degree of representation of our union. Merely because the two CP unions claimed to have representation there. They knew full well that both those CP unions put together did not even represent 15% of the workers. But on that pretext, they refused to deal with us. So we called a strike. Out of 674 workers, 550 odd came on strike. No, not 550, some 570 to begin with. And about 100 remained inside. Still they refused. And said that the 550 odd who have come out on strike include a large number who are staying out through fear. Now the strike has continued for 82 days. And in the meantime, quite a few have gone back to work because they couldn't hold out through sheer economic necessity. And the total now that have gone back to work, plus the people who were there at the beginning, yesterday was 312. So as I said to the Labour Department, even today, after 82 days strike, more than 50% on strike. Do you still challenge the fact that we are the most representative union in that workplace? That is that after 82 days, we still have an absolute majority on strike.
How would you explain the individual desertions back from your party to NM's worker? I'm thinking in particular of
Kara Singham and people like that.
Yes, I don't know whether it applies to Osman Jayaratne and HADS.
Ah, you're the first to go. HADS never broke. HADS was with us in the Central Committee in all the earlier stages of the fight. But when it came to the crucial stage with his university aspirations, he wobbled because N.M. Pereira going into the government was now going to be another factor entirely. So there it was a question of his personal career and his political conviction. Well, I think his career
triumphed
at a crucial meeting, one of the most crucial meetings, I think, where it was going to be decided ultimately by one or two votes. He didn't turn up. And the meeting went on till about 11 o'clock in the night. After the meeting finished, we went to snacks bar, some of us, for dinner. And whom do we find there? HCDS Munasekar. He had cut. He had come to Colombo and he had cut. And he couldn't face us. When I went and met him and I just, you know, I ragged him and said, what the hell, man? You got cold feet and stayed away. He just couldn't open his mouth. So, these are the fellows. Now he was made director of the People's Bank. You see, he got the payoff. L.C. De Silva. He was a fellow who was definitely, for quite a long period of time, thoroughly alien from this present line. He belonged to the traditional LSSC thinking.
That is, what I mean, a revolutionary?
Yes, mm-hmm. Which was the traditional thinking in the LSSP. This other one was the new thing, you see, the
opportunism.
Yeah. So, ultimately, he went over when it came to the break, when he knew, now, it's this or that. He went over with the majority. And he got the payoff. He got a parliamentary seat. He was appointed to that, some lotteries board or something like that.
What's his social background?
He's a businessman. Now he has been unseated because of that. He's quite a decent guy. I don't blame those fellows. You see, they all got demoralized, like Robert. They were all good LSSPers. I'm just giving you a few examples, but I can tell you workers even. Many of these workers, at one time, were real devoted fellows, ready to sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they believed in the party. Once they found the leaders were just ready to, mortgage their political fortunes and at least political principles for their parliamentary position, they got completely demoralized. Then their position was, we'll also then make the best of it.
Can you think? Give me one or two examples of workers. I'm very interested at that.
Why not? There was a fellow in the harbour called Alexander. He has now left the party also. He's in that some other union in the harbour. Even the Spantis.
End of interview.